Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 26th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon, we have Joel Mugg. Today's session number is 98-3 and is titled Liberating Journeys, The Quest for Global Justice Through Cross-Cultural Encounter. Let's listen in.
Begin. Looks like we'll have an intimate group this afternoon, which is always nice. My name is Joel Muggy, and this session is entitled Liberating Journeys, Global Justice and Cross-Cultural Encounter. And for those of you that, some of you have been in some of my previous sessions, what I've done this week is try to talk about a couple of the pillars of experiential education, one being a sort of transformational education pedagogy, and then also a session on liberation theology, which is also provides one of the groundwork upon which our work has been based. For the last 16 years, I was director of the Center for Global Education at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And the mission of that institution was to bring people face to face with those struggling for justice and human dignity in various parts of the world. And as a result of that, to challenge participants to re-examine their own roles and the role of our nation in addressing those global realities. In our work at the center, we placed emphasis on, or priority, I guess one would say, on listening to the voices of those whose voices are least often heard, namely the poor and the oppressed in many parts of the world. But at the same time, we really believe that it was important that learners hear as many perspectives as possible about the kinds of realities we were addressing. During those 16 years, we, and the center continues to do that, although I'm no longer working with the center, we established or developed experiences for over 6,000 people in 35 countries around the world. And these were in the form generally of anywhere from a week to 3 week experiences with a very intensive kind of program, immersing people into the realities of the countries that we visited. And one of the distinctive, on these journeys, if you will, or we call them travel seminars, one of the distinctive features of the center's work has been, I think, the way in which we've tried to establish relationships of collaboration and partnership in the countries where we work. Very early in our history, it became clear that considerable care had to be taken in building relationships in the countries where we had done our work, and that relationships of trust were vital to the kind of education that we wanted to do. We didn't want to be just another bunch of gringos plopping ourselves into some community and sucking the life out of that community, which has been a typical North American posture. And so we began to establish study centers. We hired permanent staff in the locations where we were working, who lived there and became integrated into the community. And we've also now tried to develop cross-cultural teams in many of the places where we worked. And so now we have staff in Mexico, Central America, Namibia, and Southern Africa, and that becomes a base for our work. Before I go any further, however, I think I want to tell you a couple stories today, because one of my goals for this session is simply for you to have a feel of what this kind of travel education is about. And if you haven't done something like this, to encourage you to do it at some point in your life. And so what I want to do is just share a couple stories out of my experience that I hope will illustrate the nature of this kind of experience and the kind of impact it can have on people. So I'm going to begin with a story today, and then I'm going to end with another story. And in between, who knows what we'll do. We'll see. The first story took place in the Philippines, I think about 8 years ago. We were traveling with a group of seminarians from the West Coast, mostly from Pacific Lutheran Seminary and San Francisco Theological Seminary. And we'd been in the Philippines about a little less than a week, I believe. And that particular set of, we were on a three-day trip up into the Bataan Peninsula of the Philippines. And included in the Bataan Peninsula is Subic Naval Base, which is in the northern part of the peninsula. And we were going to end our trip at Subic Naval Base and spend a night there. But the first night, the first day or so, a day and a half of programming, was being coordinated by a group, our host organization in the Philippines. And we had basically put those 2 days in their hands to program as they would, knowing the kind of objectives we have for our trip. And so we had spent the afternoon, and what I'm going to share with you is a 24-hour period that for me was one of the most interesting 24 hours I've ever spent on my many years of doing travel seminars, and one that I think gives you a flavor of the kind of things that one can experience. We had just spent an afternoon in the Bataan Export Processing Zone, and those of you know what that is. It's kind of a free trade zone where companies can come in from other parts of the world, establish plants, get labor very cheaply, not pay taxes, usually assemble something or put something together and ship it out of the country. We won't get into the politics of that, but nevertheless. We had been there, and one of the interesting things that had happened when we were touring a clothing plant where they were making blue jeans. And a woman, our group was walking through, and one of the women looked at one of our participants and said, "I made your pants." And sure enough, it kind of peeled the label back, and it was made in that factory whenever it had been made, right there in that spot. That pair of jeans had come full circle. Anyway, as we finished our tour of the processing zone, and we're heading up the peninsula to a town a little further up on Manila Bay, where we were going to be hosted by a Christian community group and then spend the night in families. Well, it was about mid-afternoon, and it began to get dark as though it were night, and it was the monsoon season in the Philippines. And as we had just headed out up the peninsula, a deluge began. Just incredible rain that I'd seldom seen that kind of rain before in my life. But gradually the bus made progress, and it was getting increasingly dark until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it was almost as dark as night. And the rain kept coming, and we would come over little rises, and then we'd come down into the lower parts of the road, and each time we'd come down, we were going through a little more water each time. And finally we came over a rise, and stretched out before us was like a river, kind of heading off in this direction. And without real clarity about how deep it was, we could see the road coming up out of the wash on the other side. And we watched as a bus came from the other side and went down through the water and its headlights just kind of floating along the surface and then came back out. So sure enough, our bus driver heads into the water, and we all have images of Manila Bay, which is probably a half mile off to the right. But sure enough, the bus goes into the water, and we get almost to the other side. It sputters a little bit, but we come back up, and there we are, high and dry, and fine, we made it through. It was not probably 10 minutes more, and we came over another rise and an even wider gulf of water. And so we headed the same thing here coming. Now, by now it's completely dark, and we see more headlights coming across the water, so we head into this water again. We get about halfway across, and this time the bus sputters. The engine's kind of underneath the bus, right? So it's low. And the engine stops right in the middle of the stream. And so we decide, well, what can we do? We roll up our pant legs and we get out and start to push the bus. And another Philippine bus, public transportation, and meets us halfway in this middle of this lake now, which it has become. The bus stops. Half the people get off the bus and help us push the bus back up onto high ground. And then they slosh back through the water, get back on the bus, and off they go. And so then we dry off the distributor and finally make it to the town. So by this time we're wet, you know, we've had this experience with the Filipinos pushing us out of the water, and sort of start to marvel at our whole day. Well, little did we know it had only begun, because we drove into town then, and then onto the street of the home where we were going to have supper in a person's home, and there were about 20 of us traveling. And as we turned onto the street, this street had about 6 inches of water in the street. And meanwhile, it's still raining. We drive up to the house, and we're still sitting in water. And our hosts are there to meet us. Everybody's kind of standing in water. Nobody seems to find this the least bit out of the ordinary. And so we step off the bus into about 6 inches of water, and we're ushered into the house where we're now sloshing around in about 2 inches of water in this home, in this very simple but lovely Filipino home. And they've set out a beautiful buffet for us. It's just a gorgeous buffet with all kinds of food. And we're sloshing around in the water, and we're being hosted by these people. And I tried to imagine, in my own home, being willing to host a group of 20 foreigners in the middle of a flood, and put out this wonderful buffet. And so we enjoyed our food. Halfway through the dinner, we're noticing also that the water continues to rise very slightly. And so, I mean, it's just getting higher. And we also notice that our Philippine hosts, the men are sort of watching by the doorway, and they're always looking out and keeping an eye out for everything. But the water's very slowly coming up. About halfway through our meal, the lights go out. Okay, the electricity goes out. And so very quickly, candles are passed around, and we continue our meal here in the midst of the water. And then, just about when we're finished with our meal, our host suggests that maybe we want to get back on the bus because the water appears to be continuing to rise. And by now it's about 7 o'clock in the evening, and so we get back on our bus, knowing that our next stop is to be staying with our host families in this same community. So you can imagine sort of the reaction of people of our group wondering, well, is this going to be in the midst of water? Or where are we staying? And so on that next little 15-minute journey, you could have heard a pin drop in the bus, because with the exception of a few people who were starting to hyperventilate, the anxiety level had grown fairly dramatically. And so fortunately, however, we got onto the highway where it was still dry, and then we turned off onto a dark gravel dirt road where there were no lights whatsoever, and headed uphill, thankfully, rather than downhill, and drove for perhaps a half a mile, and suddenly, all of a sudden, sort of out of nowhere, we were in the midst of a crowd of people who were there waiting for us. No lights, except the lights of the headlights, and we discovered that we were really in the midst of a rice paddy. All got off the bus. Everybody's kind of huddling around me, wondering where it is we're going. And we get ushered into many of you have seen, I think, pictures of the very indigenous kind of Filipino house that's up on stilts and bamboo, up on stilts and rice paddies. And so we went up a little ladder into the sort of the meeting hall of this community, into a bamboo hut meeting hall, very clean and nice, at which, very Spartan but very clean, at which about four or five of the participants whispered in my ear, "I'd be glad to sleep here." Always the known is better than the unknown, right? And had a meeting with the village there. And then all of us were ushered off in twos and threes to our guests' home, sort of walking off into the night, not knowing where exactly where we're going. But most of us then taken to homes very similar to this, which we were able to lay on mats on the floor, and most people, I think, enjoyed a relatively good night's sleep, high above the ground in this Filipino huts. So the next morning, everybody's kind of gathering together. The sun has come up. We discover we are indeed in the midst of a rice paddy. The biggest point of discussion is, and exactly how did you go to the bathroom last night? Because nobody had bathrooms in these homes, you know, and everybody had a different tale of how they were escorted out onto the rice paddy somewhere under some tree, or each one had a different story, and had come together for, and then we came together for breakfast together, and then boarded our bus, thinking we were now going back going on to Subic Naval Base. Well, that was not to be the case, because we drove about 2 miles and then pulled and then got onto the main highway and then turned off onto another little road. And it was clear that we were being escorted to still yet another event on this new day in the morning. And so we headed down a road, and pretty soon we turned off the road and started walking up and over some hills through a cornfield, right through the field. And we had just gone into the cornfield, and along comes a fellow from one direction carrying a clarinet. And we went a little further, and a guy with a guitar is coming from the other direction. And pretty soon there was a guy with a tuba. And so here we were, as we were walking in, we kept being joined by these people with instruments. We didn't have a clue what was happening here. We were going, and so we went through the fields, and we got into sort of a clearing. We went through little woods and into a clearing, and there again was a large group of people gathered, and suddenly this group of musicians had come together, and they began to play some music, and we discovered that what we were at was a rice planting festival. And this was not, this was a dry rice, they were planting dry rice on the hillsides, and I don't know if any of you know about dry rice, but you basically poke holes and throw rice in the holes, and it grows actually on hillsides, it wasn't in the paddies. And so there was a whole ritual of music in which people were dancing as they were planting the rice, and our group got to dance and plant rice, and we shared some music, and they shared some music, and it was a wonderful celebration that people experienced that day. Well, you can imagine as we got back on the bus to leave, the kind of reflection as we thought back on our last 24 hours, all of the things that I had experienced in that time. And as we drove up to the Bataan Peninsula, or up to Subic Naval Base, the bus was actually very quiet, but every now and then you'd hear somebody just chuckle. Or you'd hear somebody, you know, you'd hear some exchanges about their experience. And is it in the final reflection of that trip, those 24 hours were one of the most important experiences for people that, for many of them in their life. Because of the elements of the kind of elements that were present, the tremendous, the deep and profound new understanding of what hospitality is about. I mean, just imagine that, the kind of gracious hospitality for that meal in the midst of a flood. The tremendous learning that happens out of in surprising situations where you're not sure, where you let yourself be open to something new that we're not in control of. When we give sort of the power over to others to really be our teachers about their own experience. And so that 24 hours for me sort of, I think, is a remarkable example of just the profound kinds of experience and learning that can take place in a cross-cultural situation. And we could talk about experience. Those of you who have been on travel experiences like this one, I think, can point to other examples of times when that learning is just so profound, and it wasn't planned. It came out of in a very spontaneous way. The kind of work that the center has done in the years that we've been working is the kind of travel education we do is not unique in the sense that there are many other organizations that have done similar kind of work. I think we have a kind of unique approach that I'm going to share with you in a minute. But there are many organizations that I would commend you to if you're thinking about this for yourself, who do similar kinds of work. Many of you may be familiar with an organization on the U.S.-Mexico border called Borderlinks. Which does this kind of education on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Many of you are familiar with Witness for Peace, which has done travel education solidarity work in Central America and other parts of the world for many years. Organizations like Global Exchange in San Francisco and many others have done this kind of what has come to be known in many different ways, sometimes as travel education, immersion education, but it has much of the same character. But I think there are a couple of things that I want to share about the way we have the way we have thought about our work that that I think gives it a slightly unique twist. Some of you know, I think, Dan Spencer. Dan actually is going to be one of the summer program staff coordinators here next summer. Dan teaches at Drake University, and for many years was on the staff of the Center for Global Education in Minneapolis. One of the about three or four of our staff people that I give Larry Rasmussen a bad time that he has snatched out of us and brought them to New York to study with him. But Dan recently did a sort of a retrospective on the work of the center over our first years of history, and he talked about the centers. He used the analogy of leaving home and returning home again with new eyes new eyes and commitments. And he used that sort of metaphor as a way of describing the kind of learning process, as he understood it, of the Center for Global Education. And I want to just kind of share that framework that Dan described with you, because I think it's very helpful. First, he says, he talks about really four stages in this kind of learning process. The first stage he calls the view from home, recognizing how our views of home are shaped. Each of us has a distinct kind of social location, if you will, or how the intersection of social factors has shaped our experience, our worldview, and our perception of reality. Each of us as we've grown up and lived in our society, we've each been shaped in a particular way. And it creates, in my first session I talked about ideological cocoons, and it really, this shaping really shapes a kind of ideological cocoon for us, a way we, it sort of puts the limits around our view of the world. Immersing ourselves intensively in another cultural and geographical home, if you will, can help us to see what has shaped us and our home environments more self-critically and accurately. And so one of the things I think it's important to mention in this kind of education is that the goal is not even so much to really try to understand the other, and certainly to begin a process, the goal is really to understand ourselves more clearly so we can be open to the other. And it's one of, as much of my work has been in cross-cultural education and training, and I think one of the fallacies of cross-cultural training, as it's been done so much around the world, is training people simply to know how to follow the rules of another culture, rather than to really understand ourselves as cultural beings and how we are shaped as cultural beings so we can recognize that others are different and don't think in the same way and be more open to them. So the first stage is that recognizing our own cultural biases, recognizing that we are cultural beings and understanding what has shaped us. The second stage, Dan calls entering new homes, confronting new worldviews and breaking out of our own ideological cocoons. In other words, breaking out of that worldview. In the encounter with people and places very different from our own homes, many program participants, I think, and many travelers find themselves confronted by experiences and perspectives that radically call into question our own values and assumptions. I think most people who allow themselves into this kind of travel experience would come away with that notion. And I think, frankly, it's the reason why many people choose not to do this, because it's taking a risk, knowing that you may be forced into change. And initially, this can cause a crisis of belief and an attempt to hold together my own ideological cocoon. You know, I want to keep it in. It's the familiar, and we want to stay with the familiar and comfortable. One of our approaches is that we're doing all of this in community. It's a living, learning community that's participating on this kind of experience, and it's through that community experience, I think, that often sort of the support and encouragement comes to really open ourselves up to the process of change, and it's in this stage of sort of breaking out of our cocoons that we begin to be able to see the world through the eyes of the other person. Okay. Begin to look at the world, not how we would look at it if we were there, but how that person really looks at the world. The third stage is really, and Dan talks about it, the first two stages are kind of before and during the experience itself. The second two stages are after the experience. The third stage is one of feeling alienated from home. Trying to reconcile the irreconcilable. And again, I think those of you who have traveled in this way know that feeling of coming home and feeling alienated. Returning home is often difficult as we begin to grasp the incompatibility of our previous views of the world as we have held the previous views we've held with our new experiences and perspectives. And I think we recognize this is a very critical moment in a transformative pedagogy because the dissonance caused by these irreconcilable worldviews can either be transforming for people or it can be immobilizing. It can cause you to just say, I can't do anything. And the outcome, I think, depends largely on whether one is able to connect with others who share that new worldview, or if that person remains isolated amidst others who's with a worldview that no longer works for them. And so one of our goals as we bring people back from these kind of experiences, we often have groups that are scattered around the country, and so the group doesn't remain intact. So what we try to do is plug them into resources and people in their communities that can be a basis of support for them. But that's often difficult, and it's one of the things that's often very frustrating for us has been to be able to tie them back into a community of support so that they don't feel immobilized by their experience. And then the fourth stage that Dan describes is what he calls prophetic homemaking. That is, opting for a new sense of home. And so the final moment, really, or the final stage in this transformative pedagogy is our participation in the transformation of our own social reality. Once we have a transformed worldview, it's to engage in a process of transforming our society. We discover that homes are not simply lived in, experienced passively, but rather are actively made as we live in them. And this means to have to decide what kind of homes we choose to inhabit and with whom we'll work to build them and how we will build them. It means discerning carefully what are both the limiting and the enabling social and ecological constraints that shape the context in which we build our homes. Said simply, it's the question of what do we do with this experience? Are we empowered by it? And if we are, what are the ways in which we actively engage in transforming our own social reality? So, as one can see, that to decide to take this kind of liberating journey is not involves a great deal of discernment, because it means the possibility one's going to be opening oneself to a sharp transformation that will forever change one's life. And I think we can point to testimonies again and again of people whose lives have taken dramatic turns because of their participation in this kind of experience. I think of one gentleman who participated on an early experience in Cuernavaca. He owned a factory in southern Minnesota. And he tells about after a day in Cuernavaca, Mexico, in which they had visited squatter settlements, he tells about waking up in the middle of the night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he found himself just weeping. And this man at that time was 68 years old, he's now close to 80. And he could not get out of his mind the children who had greeted him in that barrio and just the whole experience. Since that time, he, in addition to being a major donor to the work of the Center for Global Education, he has sold his factory to his employees in an ESOP, it's called an Employee Stock Ownership Plan. He has moved himself out of the business, developed a foundation with basically the proceeds of the sale of the company. The company, before he left it, he got it involved, and it's continuing today in a program called Cross Boundaries, in which now 25% of this factory and its management have participated in international travel seminars abroad on company time and at company expense. And then his own foundation has become involved in assisting in transformative development projects both in Nicaragua and in the United States. So you see, this is maybe a more dramatic example, but the kind of transformative capacity that this kind of experience can have for people. Now, one of the things that's, I think, and again, I'm just trying to give you a flavor of some of the kinds of things that we do, and so I want to do something that involves you a little bit in this as well. Because one of the things that's critical for this kind of education is really preparing people with the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So one of the things that we try to put a good deal of effort on the kind of preparation we do for people so that they can maximize this learning experience, so it will be an empowering experience and not a immobilizing one. And one of those things, and part of that task is really helping people gives people some tools to process the kind of experience they're going to process. And I'd like to do just one exercise with you here this afternoon that gives you a feel for that, and I think it also gives you a feel for the kind of values that are critical in this kind of experience. I want you to just sit back for a moment, and I'm going to show you a picture, and I want you simply to observe the picture for just a moment or two. You need to move to get a clear view of it, that's fine. Okay, I want you to tell me, just in a word or two, and maybe you can just throw out a word or a very short phrase, I want you to tell me what you see.
I see a child of both people that is trying to escape war-torn country.
Okay. What else?
Distressful. Alone.
Sadness. Rejection.
Sort of a target on that person.
Okay. What else do you see?
Hunger.
Hunger?
In between places, he's not where he was, he's not where he's going.
Child anymore, sort of a grown up, old and experienced.
All right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Hopeless.
Okay, now I want to change the question. And I want you to tell you, as you look at this picture, how do you feel? Sad?
I want to help him.
Okay.
Want to know his story?
Where is his family?
Okay, I'm going to stop there just for the sake of time. Tell me the difference between these two lists.
Concrete versus emotional.
Okay, concrete versus emotional. Any other? Remember that I asked you, what did you see? What did most of you tell me? What you, really even more what you thought. You know, some over here we got into what you felt when I asked you that. Even then, some of you told me what you thought. Right? When I asked what you saw, you told me what you thought. Or you told me the interpretations that you made about what you saw. Right? A couple of people told me a child. I mean, I think that's, we could pretty much all agree that that's a child. I put this over here, but that's even a little questionable about whether that's a target, because what is that really? You know what that is?
Postmark.
It's a gun sight.
Oh, a gun sight.
It's a gun sight. All right? Now, one of the things that happens very often when we head into any kind of new experience, we're very quick to begin to draw some conclusions based on our own worldview and our assumptions about the world, right? And so, let's come back to this for a minute and say, all right, what did you see? Can you come back to what it was in this picture? What's the data? What is it you saw that led you to that conclusion? And could there have been another conclusion? Right? So now, I think one of the first ones was distrustful. And so what did you see? Whoever said distrustful, try to get back to what did you see in this picture, concretely?
It was his eyes. What I see in his eyes.
Okay, and what about those eyes? Can you?
I don't know. I don't know how to. I do see red. There's some redness under his eyes.
Right.
Which suggests trauma.
Right. Many of these had a kind of character to them, right? A similar character. Can one imagine an interpretation of this picture that is totally different from? Somebody imagine some other sort of picture of what this could be?
He might be sick.
He could be sick, sure.
Could be waiting for his mother.
He's being taken back and reunited to with his family.
Okay. He could be cold, right? He may just be mad at his parents for something. You could be bored, right? But we were all sitting here in a seminar on global education and global justice, right? So this must be about, a refugee or something of that nature, right? I mean, it's a very logical, natural sort of, this is very logical. And yet, it doesn't serve us very well when we go into a cross-cultural situation to very quickly come to these conclusions. I shared the other day, what happens also often in our travel seminars is that about by the end of the first day, people are already proposing how we can help this person, right? Without trying to really understand what is this person's experience. Interestingly enough, it's usually with my apologies to any clergy in the group, it's usually the clergy who are the first to offer help, because that's how we've been trained, right? Now, where do you think this person is from?
Vietnam,
okay. Others?
Mexico.
Could be Iran?
Cambodia? Could be the U.S.
U.S.? All right, where that person is, I mean, would give you, wherever we determine that person is from, could change dramatically the nature of that meaning of that picture for us, right? In terms of what it's about. Let me do this and see. Okay, now it suddenly takes on a whole new level of meaning for those of you that are familiar with Nicaraguan history, right? And if you remember those years in Nicaragua, that has a whole different character to it. This happens to be a Miskito Indian boy on a boat on the Atlantic coast, and it's of course an anti-contra war poster is what this is. And it was done in an original version in 1983, and then they did it in a second version in 1984 as Contra was renewed. What I'm sort of trying to point out by this, and this is an example of an exercise that we do with people either before they go on an experience or very early in the experience, and we do have a number of these kind of things that we do, to really, first of all, help people recognize the power of their own biases and are already starting to make assumptions. And to encourage people to try to set aside those assumptions, at least early in an experience, and to try to really simply observe, to try not to make judgments and draw conclusions too early, and to really open oneself up to hear what the people they're encountering have to say, and to learn from them rather than to impose our own solutions, our own assumptions. And that's a very difficult process for us. It's very hard to do that. And it takes a lot of self-will, I think, at the beginning of an experience to do that. Any other comments on this this particular experience, or particular exercise from you? Anybody have any reactions to it?
Well, it's just really interesting to me how we've gotten those categories without knowing it.
And see, what happens, I think it's the place where cross-cultural misunderstanding can begin to happen very quickly. Because cultures can differ even at the level of observable data. We like to think that we all can see the same thing. But for example, the Inuit people, I believe they can distinguish something like 80 different kinds of snow. 80 different kinds of snow. Now, if you live at Holden during the winter, maybe you can distinguish, 10 to 15, maybe. You know, there's powder, and I mean, there's kind of two kinds of snow, wet and light. There's not that many kinds of snow in my repertoire. But so even we would disagree even on our interpretation of data. Let alone the conclusions we draw, we might see the same thing and draw totally different conclusions. For example, I might be with an Asian person and that person smiles, and I might think, oh, well, they're happy or they're relaxed in this situation. Whereas it's a common custom in Asia that smiling can also be a way of hiding nervousness, right? And so, without having that cultural understanding, if I simply react on the basis of how I would react in that situation, I have missed the boat. And then, when you get to the level of feeling and what kind of reaction it causes, the same experience in one culture can cause a totally different feeling in another culture. Abilities for misunderstanding are great. And that's why I think it's very important for us at the beginning of this kind of experience to come back to data and really try to observe. Well, I don't want to dwell on that, but I want to give you a feel for this is the kind of groundwork that I think is laid in this kind of education that so that people can draw the most possible from this experience. I'd like to comment then just on two or three other elements of the experience that I think are really important or of travel education that have over the years people have remarked as being very significant for them. I mentioned one, this new and more profound sense of the meaning of hospitality. I think again and again we found ourselves welcome into places we can't imagine being welcomed into with the graciousness that we can't imagine we would be welcomed with. I've already suggested this for many. It's the experience of a shattering of some fundamental assumptions about their own worldview. I think this kind of experience forces many to re-examine their notion of education and how we learn, who are the teachers and who are the students in real education. I also think that what's unique about this education, if it's done well, is the ability to make connections across boundaries of race, nationality, and class without blurring or minimizing those differences. And I hope you understand what I mean there, because I think there are some approaches, some kinds of even theological approaches that sort of want to say we're kind of one big happy family and can't we all get together and then it's going to be a beautiful world, right? And to be able to create these connections across difference without minimizing the difference or negating the difference, I think is a very important dynamic of good cross-cultural education. And finally, I think for Christians, I think this kind of experience opens up a whole new view of mission. Many of you, I think, heard of the term reverse mission, where we kind of discover that maybe when we go on this kind of experience, it's really them missioning to us. I actually really prefer, I think, the whole concept of partnership, where there's a certain mutuality about it, that we all have something to learn and to gain in this kind of interaction. I want to close with another story, and it's a much different story than the first one. But before I do that, I'd like to just ask if there are any other comments about those of you who have been on this kind of experience. What would you point to as the kind of thing that's been most critical for you in your own process? Or any other comments? Yeah.
Well, I think it's the invitation to see the world from different perspectives. And it's really helped me not to make snap judgments about people I meet. You know, as soon as I find out an identifying feature about a person, in the past I've been prone to put them in a neat little category and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I know that person grew up Missouri Synod, you know, and well, you know what that means. And it's freed me from that, so yeah. That I know that there's always more to know about a person.
Yeah.
And I can just reserve my judgments. I don't need to make judgments, because the exciting thing is that people are changing and growing and developing. And I think that occurred to me, in Cuernavaca and El Salvador and Nicaragua, when we went into the homes of the poor people, you know. Oh, pity the poor people. And then you discover just how rich they were in a full family life, in being truly grateful for what they had, you know, yeah. In the way that we weren't. And we ended up being the ones who received. Could I add just a little aside?
Yeah, please do.
We went to the De Young Museum in San Francisco recently, and there was a special exhibit of ethnographic art. And I thought, you know, all of the learning that the Center for Global Education introduced me to was really fulfilled in a way. The art exhibit, Keith Morrison, an African-American artist, put it together. And he had selected from different ethnic groups pieces of art that you might call typical of that group. And then he had a commentary about them, a label on them. So that there was a Madonna and child from, a Mexican church.
Mm.
And instead of just the picture itself, the painting, he put votive candles underneath and these little, almost like medallions or medals, you know, so you could see it a little more as it would appear in the context. Mm. Well, the one art object that tickled me the most because of Keith's interpretation was a coffee mug with a reproduction of a Van Gogh painting on it. And you know, we're all drinking our Starbucks coffee out of these kinds of mugs. But he wrote the description of it as if he were from another culture, not, you know.
Right.
And he talked about this vessel. It is thought that this vessel was used to imbibe a caffeine-laden and it is unknown why the reproduction of this painting was placed on it, unless it's thought by some that the beverage was consumed late at night, and this was, you know, it was Van Gogh's crows flying over the field, you know. It was just hilarious, you know. The vessel is made of porcelain and so on. Well, his point was that we view Western art as timeless and universal.
Yeah.
And then, so in museums, we have so-called special exhibits for African-American art, for Nigerian art, whatever it is. And, of course, those are certainly not universal art objects. So they'll never make it into the permanent collection, you know, God forbid. And what he was doing was treating this coffee mug as if it were a special exhibit item, you see, in another.
Yeah.
And it just, oh! I thought if I were still teaching, I would have my students write a paper about a story or a poem written by a member of their own ethnic group, you know, as if they were.
As if they were.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, that's a good example of how many of these strategies can be brought into, you know, even standard school curriculums and that sort of thing. You know, this is a very dramatic way to get at some of this stuff, but it can be done in other ways as well. Yeah, yeah.
Kind of building on what Jan said, one of our experience after some foreign trips was having someone of another culture live with us for mm-hmm. 4 years. And then also going to her home, her parents' home, which was or her mother's home, which was a very traditional home. And then my husband spent a week with her in her home now. And I think if anything, it taught us that there is no way to totally, I mean, she couldn't explain to us totally her culture.
Right.
And there still are a million questions I have about how her culture sees things, because I think it's so part of us that we can't totally take it. I mean, we can't explain to her, and we would have dialogues, like she was very critical of American culture, and then we turned to her and we'd say, Esther, if you weren't culturally correct, you wouldn't be here. Because in her culture, women, you know, the old culture, women wouldn't come to the United States and study.
Right.
And so we'd have these dialogues despite all that, and despite her being a very articulate, I mean, there's stuff that I will never understand.
I think in my own experience, found that the more cross-culture experience, the more I think we are so different, and it makes it more important to find to connect across those differences, not to become the same, you know, I think it's. I want to close with this story. It's a much different story of another event on a travel seminar. Again, for me, probably one of the most profound of, and I think it'll become evident why. And this was, I was traveling with a group of Kellogg Fellows, a program of the Kellogg Foundation in Battle Creek in South Africa. And so I want to share this story with you as a close. I had barely met him. I did shake his hand when we arrived, and I had noted the confident and self-assured manner in which he approached us group of strangers. During the evening, I was aware of the intensity of the conversation at the end of the table where he was seated, and I remember feeling a bit jealous of those who were close enough to be part of that interaction, but at the same time, I was really ready for a chance to relax a bit. We'd been in South Africa for nearly a week, and the combination of jet lag, the intensity of the experience, and the responsibilities of facilitating the seminar were beginning to take their toll. So I savored my wine, South African wine is very good, and I tried to tune out the fragments of conversation that occasionally drifted my way from the end of the table. Little did I realize that not only would I soon know most of what was said in that conversation, but also that this was to be an evening that I would not be able to tune out for the rest of my life. It was to have been an informal welcome dinner hosted by the staff and board of the Peter Maritzburg Agency for Christian Social Awareness. It's known as PAXA for short. PAXA has, they were our hosts for our visit to that city, and they've been involved for many years in working for nonviolent change in a part of South Africa where violence was on the increase at that time in Natal province. Skumbuso Mbatha was the only black person from PAXA in attendance at the dinner. He was a PAXA community organizer in the black township of Imbale and was also a regional official with the African National Congress, with the ANC. It had been a very pleasant evening of conversation, and at about 10 o'clock as the evening was drawing to a close, Skumbuso glanced nervously at his watch and excused himself, indicating that it was a bit risky for him to be out on the streets at such a late hour, and he was anxious to get home to his wife and three children. 3 or 4 minutes after he left our presence, we heard 5 or 6 loud pops outside the restaurant. It was a minute or two before most of us realized what we had heard. But as Peter, the director of PAXA, rushed out the door, and we began to hear a woman shrieking, the horror of what was unfolding began to sink in. I followed Peter to see what had happened. By the time I reached the door of the restaurant, Peter was coming in very distraught, yelling for someone to call an ambulance. "It's Skumbuso," he yelled. "They've shot Skumbuso." By the time I got outside, a small crowd had gathered around the pickup truck where Skumbuso lay slumped over the front seat. In an apparent attempt to elude his attackers, he had backed the car out of a parking spot, scraped the car next to him, and finally backed into a tree with the truck blocking the entrance to the parking lot. In the confusion of the ensuing moment, someone thought to call for the 2 doctors in our group who quickly came forth to be of assistance, but by the time they reached Skumbuso, he had stopped breathing and his pulse was very weak. Within moments, he died in the arms of one of our group members. During the next 3 hours, the group stayed on the scene to observe the response of the South African authorities. Their initial reaction of shock and anger very quickly evolved into a commitment to ensure that Skumbuso's life and death would not go unnoticed. Several people began to write down their reactions and their feelings as a way of beginning to deal with their own anger and grief. Naturally, those who had been with Skumbuso at dinner were the most profoundly affected by his death. They had been moved by their conversation with him and began to document as much as they could remember of what he had said. Later, as I learned more about the substance of that conversation, it became clear why Skumbuso had been targeted that evening. For many years, he had been an activist with the United Democratic Front and more recently had become a regional coordinator of the ANC. And because of his activities, he had been fired from his teaching job in the schools. He had been detained 4 times by South African police, security forces, and tortured on 2 of those occasions. He was committed to a process of nonviolent change and had been working to decrease the tensions between the ANC and Inkatha that had erupted into so much violence during that time, and I think you all remember that time when that was so strong. He had no illusions about the so-called black-on-black violence that was thwarting efforts towards change in South Africa at the time. He was very clear about government provocation of violence aimed at destabilizing the black community. Well, some were documenting their recollections of Scambuzo's conversations. Others were observing the reactions of the South African police to the assassination. And I think even the most generous description of their response would have to characterize it as inept and unprofessional. There was no attempt to cordon off the area to protect the evidence, nor to interview any of the several witnesses who had been on the scene. After about an hour, an observer suggested they put out a bulletin describing the escape vehicle. One of the officers responded, "Oh, I suppose that's a good idea." And for the rest of our time in South Africa, and in the months that followed the trip, the group took advantage of every opportunity to push both South African and U.S. officials to call for a serious investigation of Scambuzo's death. Their efforts did result in the arrest and prosecution of three people for his murder. They were, however, acquitted. But that arrest in itself was a very rare occurrence in the South Africa at that time, when the victims of political violence was black. And in addition, the group helped to establish an educational trust for Scambuzo's children. But I think the most important thing to recognize here is the profound effect that that death had on those of us who had been part of the experience. It brought us each much closer to the struggle of the South African people and committed and empowered us to work for change in a way that would otherwise have not been the case. And I think it could be said to be true that Scambuzo Mbatha is very and continues to be very much alive in each of us who were with him for those few brief hours that day. As my own way of processing that experience in the days and weeks follows, I began to reflect a bit on what Scambuzo might have thought of that evening, as he reflected upon it, let's put it that way. And so I want to close this afternoon with what I think might be Scambuzo's words. "Now you know a bit of our pain. You have brushed against the horror that invades our lives almost every day. I wanted you to understand, but God knows, I, of all people, did not want it to happen this way. But it was out of our control, yours and mine, and through it you have been drawn deeper into our struggle. You have felt the pain, yet you knew me for only a couple of hours. You did not cuddle me to your breast when I was a child, nor love me through the turbulence of my adolescence. You did not bear our children and suffer the loneliness of caring for them during my imprisonment. And you did not wait for me at the gate when I came home each day to put your arms around me and tell your papi about your day at school. I miss them, you know, and they miss me so very much. Even you felt the pain, so imagine what theirs must be like. Those who have loved me, cared for me, struggled with me all these years. Yet perhaps they were more prepared for it than you. They have endured the brutality of apartheid. They have experienced the death of many friends and relatives who were committed to the struggle. I think they probably knew in their hearts that someday something like this would happen. I didn't want to come that night. It wasn't just because of the risk. There was always a risk, and I have tried not to let my life be controlled by fear. But I had been gone all week, and I longed for some time with my family. Nevertheless, something drew me that evening. Something brought me to that restaurant in spite of the fact that I really wanted to stay home. I soon realized that you were different than other groups I had met with. I could see it in your eyes when you welcomed me. I could sense it in the way you treated each other. I could feel it in the intensity of your questions and your commitment. It was one of the few times that I felt that my sharing with foreigners might make a difference." I think one of the keys to the kind of experience that I've been trying to share with you today is maybe reflected in that last paragraph. That what we've tried to do is open people to this kind of experience and to approach it in a way that maybe somehow it might make a difference. And I hope you too, at some point, if you have not had the opportunity, will take advantage of some kind of opportunity for that kind of profound cross-cultural encounter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.